Hello, listeners and friends. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, June 10th. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. Why don't we go ahead and have a quick look around the front page for today's Nonpareil? Our first headline reads, Reynolds signs critical race theory ban into law. Big story calls forecast, as summer nears, June heat set to continue. The next article says LC Board greenlights repairs to high school parking lot. Let's see, next one. Blunt message, search for answers, mark VP's first foreign trip. And the last headline on the front page of the Nonpareil for today reads, Keep Iowa First, GOP leads in early voting states say. All right, why don't we flip over to that first story headline, which read, Reynolds signs critical race theory ban into law. This is filed by Aaron Murphy of the Des Moines Bureau, Dateline, Des Moines. Iowa public colleges, school districts, and government entities are prohibited from teaching so-called divisive concepts, including that moral character is determined by one's race or sex, or that the United States and Iowa are fundamentally or systematically racist. Under new legislation signed into law Tuesday by Governor Kim Reynolds. The legislation itself was a divisive concept. In large part, Republicans supported and Democrat opposed the proposal. Critical race theory is about labels and stereotypes, not education. It teaches kids that we should just judge others based on race, gender, or sexual identity rather than the content of someone's character, Reynolds, a Republican, said in a statement. I am proud to have worked with the legislature to promote learning, not discriminatory indoctrination. Democrats argued the legislation, House File 802, stifles schools' control over their curriculum and threatens to squelch the teaching of and discussion over uncomfortable issues like racism. We can't educate ourselves if we stifle ourselves, if we stifle our teachers, Republican Ako Abdul-Samad said. Democrat from Des Moines said during legislative debate in March. Reynolds also on Tuesday signed into law without any line item votes. First up, Justice System Budget Bill House File 861, which introduces an additional $21 million for state prison systems, including $3 million for salaries at Anamosa. Two state workers were killed earlier this year during an attack by inmates at Anamosa facility. They've got unfiled petitions, so it will help them get to where they need to be to make sure that we're adequately staffed, Reynolds said Tuesday during a radio interview. The Judicial Branch Budget, House File 864. She also signed the Public Education Budget, House File 868. The State Transportation Budget, Senate File 592. Signing the Economic Workforce Development Budgets, House File 871. She also signed House File 8348. File allows alcohol sales to start at 6 a.m. on Sundays instead of 8 a.m. House File 522, a bill allowing anaerobic digesters rather than open-air manure pits at animal feeding operations. Anaerobic digesters, which have been used at watershed treatment plants for decades, can convert manure and food waste into methane, which then can be changed into electricity and heat. The leftover digestive, which doesn't smell like manure, can be applied to farm fields. Our next article is quite fitting for today. It's about the heat forecast for the rest of June and this summer. The headline reads, Forecast. As summer nears, June heat set to continue. This is filed by Mike Brownlee of the Nonpareil. It hasn't been this hot in early June since well a year ago. A consistent run of days in the 90s continued on Wednesday, with temperatures around 91 in the afternoon. The high today is around 95, according to National Weather Service meteorologist Corey Mead. It's definitely been above normal in regard to daytime temps, said Mead, who's with the Service Valley, Nebraska office. Highs are traditionally in the low 80s in early June, with lows in the low 60s, Mead said. June 4 marked the first day of 90-plus temperatures, followed by 94 on Saturday, 92 on Monday, and 92 on Tuesday. Saturday's clouds cover kept things at 85. Friday brings a 70% chance of rain during the day and a 30% chance at night. It's going to be an interesting day. It appears we'll have some showers and storms move into Friday morning, then could linger throughout the day, Mead said. The current high is 89. We're not sure how widespread the rain activity will be during the afternoon. There could be some lingering clouds. Depending on how much cloud coverage there is, it could be cooler than 89, he said. If there are fewer clouds, we could get up to 90 again. The heat wave is similar to what the metro area experienced in June of 2020 when it hit at least 90 from June 1 to June 9 on the way to 17 days at or above 90 in the month. As for the rest of this month, Mead noticed, the confidence in the forecast decreases as we go further out, but the June 16 to 22nd outlook calls for a good chance of above normal temps. With recent high temperatures, the Metro Area Planning Agency for the Council Bluffs Omaha Metro noted a ozone alert for the Douglas County, Nebraska Health Department. Ground-level ozone concentrations are projected to be the moderate range today per the Federal Air Quality Index. Tips to mitigate ozone problems include combining errands into a single trip when driving, carpooling when possible, reducing energy use, buying non-toxic cleaning materials. Go to airnow.gov for more information on air quality levels. The forecast for today is sunny with a high near 95, calm wind becoming south-southeast 5 to 8 miles per hour in the morning. Tonight, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 4 a.m., mostly clear with a low around 72, south to southeast winds from 6 to 8 miles per hour. Friday's forecast, a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms before 7 a.m., then showers likely and possible and a thunderstorm between 7 a.m. and 1 p.m., then a chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m., mostly sunny with a high near 89, south to southeast winds 5 to 7 miles per hour, becoming northwest in the afternoon. A chance of precipitation is 70%, noon nightfall amounts between a quarter and a half inch of rain possible. Friday night, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms before 1 a.m., partly cloudy with a low around 65, north wind 5 to 7 miles per hour, new rainfall amounts less than a tenth of an inch of rain, expected higher amounts possible in thunderstorms. And remember, with the higher temperatures, always drink lots and lots of water, and if you are going outside, bring that water and sunscreen with you. It will benefit you for a long time to come. All right, on to our next story on the front page. The headline reads, LC Board Greenlights Repairs to High School Parking Lot. This is filed by Tim Johnson of the Nonpareil. The Lewis Central Community School District Board of Education approved pavement repairs, renewal of software licenses, and the purchase of requested band instruments and set its meeting schedule for the 2021 school year. The paving project will focus on repairs to the asphalt in the high school parking lot and a service road around the stadium. If you've spent any time on the high school parking lot, you know it's bad, it's dangerous, Superintendent Eric Nost said. It's in dire need of repair, some of it's in need of replacement. Portions of the old pavement will be removed and replaced with 6 inches of new asphalt. Speed bumps will be maintained. The contract was awarded to Century Asphalt, which submitted a bid of $64,606.01, the lowest of three. Any damage caused by heavy equipment involved in the contract of the high school addition will be taken care of by the contractor on that project, Nost said. The heaviest work on the project will be done soon. The board voted to renew licenses for several software products the district uses. Software and the renewal costs are included in the following. iReady diagnostic assessments in reading and math from curriculum associates. The three-year license costs $149,884.45. PowerSchool system for managing student data, registration, state reporting, and human resources documents will cost $51,215.30. Illuminate data and assessment will cost $21,264.88. The board approved the purchase of marching percussion instruments from the Marching Exchange for a total of $24,900 and the purchase of other band instruments from Ryman and Schmidt Music for a total of $18,607. The acquisitions are needed primarily due to wear on existing instruments, according to Dave Black, school improvement specialist. Members also approved a change order in the high school addition project for additional welds on steel beams, matte black paint on fire-related door at the rear of the stage, and porcelain floor tile in alcove for a total of $8,683.69, according to a description from BVH Architecture. The changes will not add any days to the contract time. The board adopted the Lewis Central District Development Service Directory Plan for special education students in preschool through 12th grade as approved by Green Hills Area Education Agency. Finally, the board announced the schedule for school board meetings during the 2021-22 school year. Meetings will continue to be held primarily at 6:30 p.m. on the first and third Mondays of each month. However, a few adjustments were made to avoid meeting on holidays or during a school break. To avoid meeting on Labor Day, the board will hold three meetings in August on August 2nd, 6th, 30th, and meet only once in September on September 20. To avoid meeting on the day after winter break, the board set January meetings for January 10, 2022. Rather than meeting during spring break, the board will meet on March 21, 2022 in that month. The board's next meeting will be held at 6:30 p.m. on June 21st. On to our next story. It is a national story. The headline reads, Blunt Message, Search for Answers, Mark VP's First Foreign Trip. This was filed by Alexandria Jaffe of the Associated Press, Mexico City. Vice President Kamala Harris came to Latin America to deliver a message rather than clinch some kind of concrete deal. She bluntly told migrants not to travel to the United States. She spoke of the evils of government corruption that led to dislocation. She urged nations to increase enforcement at their borders. She completed the journey without securing any comments to increase immigration enforcement or expand pathways to legal immigration. It was her first international trip abroad, Air Force Two, and a first step toward establishing herself on a core foreign policy issue, one that has bedeviled American presidents since at least Ronald Reagan. But as much of the trip offered her a chance to step into the international stage, speaking for the Biden administration on a key issue. It also highlighted the ambiguous nature of the portfolio President Joe Biden has handed her to address the root causes of spike in immigration at the U.S. border. Harris came away from her meetings with Guatemalan and Mexican president able to talk about commitments to work more closely with them on economic development and on combating trafficking, smuggling, and corruption. But she also faced persistent questions about her decision not to visit the U.S.-Mexico border. Republicans have seized on the fact that neither Biden nor Harris has visited the border to argue that the administration is absent on the issue. Harris has called out the Democratic left, too, for using her platform Guatemala to tell people thinking of fleeing the U.S. that they should not. Do not come, she said, invoking the dangers of the trip as well as the Biden administration's commitment to border security. Do not come. Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York called those comments disappointing and noted that it is legal to seek asylum. While White House aides have repeatedly tried to clarify that Harris' assignment is narrowly focused on Democratic solutions to the immigration situation, she was again forced to spend part of the trip meant to showcase her diplomatic chops, explaining herself. It would be very easy to say, well, travel to one place and therefore it's solved, she said. I don't think anybody thinks that would be the solution. Her foreign debut was a complex one as she attempted to engage in the deepest reasons people leave what they know to take on the perilous trekking to the U.S. border and trying to get across, whether illegally or through their right to ask for asylum. Harrison often spoke about her belief that most people don't want to leave home, and she said during her meeting with Guatemalan President Alejandro Guillamati, she says her goal is to restore hope to the region so residents no longer feel compelled to flee their homes for better opportunities in the U.S. The criticism from both Republicans and some Democrats underscored the politically fraught nature of the assignment and the difficulty Harris faces in finding success in an intractable challenge that's only grown in recent months. Illegal border crossings have increased steadily since April 2020, after President Donald Trump invoked pandemic-related powers to deny immigrants the opportunity to seek asylum, but they further accelerated under Biden. The new president quickly scrapped many of Trump's hardline border policies, most notably the program that made asylum seekers wait in Mexico, often in dangerous conditions, for court dates in the U.S. immigration court. U.S. border authorities encountered nearly 19,000 unaccompanied children in March, the highest on record. Overall, more than 170,000 encounters were reported on the border in April, the highest level in more than 20 years. The numbers aren't exactly comparable because getting stopped under pandemic-related authorities carries no legal consequences, promoting some people who are caught once to keep trying. Still, analysis praised Harris's first in-person foray into the region, noting that even as her political opponents attempt to distill the margin issue to the situation at the border, the vice president reflected a clear grasp of the nuances of the challenge. You're completely unrealistic if you think there is some magic bullet to stop this stuff, said Eric Olson, director of policy at the Seattle Foundation, a group focused on good governance in Latin America. There's very little you can do to stop migration quickly. Better to acknowledge it and set the groundwork to address the long-term issues. Olson praised Harris for pledging during her press conference with the Guatemalan president to fight corruption and focusing her meetings in the region on civil society groups and small business owners rather than the private sector. And he said that getting Mexico to commit publicly to working with the U.S. on economic opportunities in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador was a significant step forward because traditionally Mexico has treated Central America as an annoying guest that just walks through your yard. This is the first, maybe weak step, but it is something because they have not traditionally accepted that as their goal, he said. As of the first female U.S. vice president, Harris spent much of her trip elevating women in the region. She met female entrepreneurs in Guatemala and Mexico and announced a $40 million program in Guatemala focused on creating opportunities for young, primarily indigenous women. Harris, who is also the first Black and South Asian vice president, said her place in history was on her mind and informed her approach as she toured the region. I welcome showing anyone, whatever your race or gender, that you may be the first to do anything, but make sure you're not the last, she said. And in that way, let's pave the path where we create an opportunity for others to become the first in their family or their communities to do these things that perhaps others didn't think they were capable of. But God has given them that capability to achieve, and with a little help, they will, she said in Guatemala. The trip was Harris's busiest public foray yet. She held lengthy bilateral meetings with the Guatemalan and Mexican presidents, presided over roundtables with entrepreneurs and labor leaders, and took questions from the press multiple times a day. She began the trip on Air Force Two with a brief visit with her traveling press, bringing cookies baked and decorated to look like her back to reporters to mark the start of their journey. She ended her time in Mexico with an extended press conference in which she felled questions on topics including immigration enforcement and voting rights. She turns from one intractable problem to another back in Washington, where the White House has said she'll spend the next week hosting events focused on voting rights as Democrats struggle to find enough support in Congress to write broad voting protections into law. All right, on to our next article that rounds out the front page of the Nonpareil. The headline reads, Keep Iowa First, GOP Leaders in Early Voting States Say. This is from the Des Moines Bureau. The dateline is Des Moines. Republican Party leaders in four early voting states want to keep Iowa's presidential caucus first in the nation. The four states' party leaders on Tuesday released a joint statement expressing their support for the presidential nomination calendar to remain the same. In order, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina cast the first choices for president every 4 years. Democrats are weighing potential changes to that early voting calendar, threatening Iowa's first-in-the-nation caucus status, at least on the Democratic side, and Nevada recently approved legislation that would move its primary to first-in-the-nation, although the National Party would need to act before that became a reality. As the GOP leaders of the four carve-out states, we want to make clear that we stand together in protecting the presidential nominating schedule as it has existed for many years. Our alliance is strong, and we will continue to work together to preserve this historic process, said the statement from the four Republican state party leaders, including Republican Party of Iowa Chairman Jeff Kaufman. Iowa's inevitable first-in-the-state position is constantly under scrutiny, but that has increased in recent years after caucus night reporting flubs in 2012 from Republicans and 2020 Democrats. All right, that does it for the front page of the Nonpareil. Why don't we head into our next section, which is Face the Day, featuring Corbin Horton. Corbin Horton is a newcomer to the Chanticleer Community Theater stage. His role as Motel the Tailor in Fiddler on the Roof, Jr. is a wonderful character. A rather meek and poor tailor who seeks the hand of Titsful, he comes in to his own through the show, and soon you will find yourself cheering him on in the process. The character has many different sides to him that the audience will get to see and experience. Corbin goes to Trainer High School and will be a junior. He wants to go to UCLA to get his degree in theater. He came to Chanticleer on the encouragement of his best friend, Brooke Attlebury, a veteran of the Chanticleer stage. Corbin is excited to have his first performance, in his words, has become addicted to the stage. Be sure to come and see all the cast of Fiddler on the Roof, Jr. opening weekend, June 24th through the 27th. Showtimes are 7:30 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays, with Sunday matinees at 2 p.m. Tickets are $25 for adults, $20 for seniors, and $15 for students. Chanticleer is located at the Hoff Family Arts and Culture Center, 1001 South 6th Street in Council Bluffs. For more information on the upcoming Children's Theater Workshop or to order tickets, call the box office at 712-890-5601. Our next story comes from the lifestyle section. The headline reads, Omaha Rose Show opens fans to a whole new world. This is filed by Marjorie Ducey of the Omaha World Herald. Dateline, Omaha. Omaha Rose Society President Don Swanson notes three great things about the Rose Day and show beside the glorious blooms. You'll be able to see some varieties you're not familiar with, and you'll be able to see what a little care in rose gardens can produce, he said. You'll also be able to tour the Robert H. Sortz Family Rose Garden with its 200 varieties after wandering through the show Saturday at Lawrence Gardens. This is the 63rd year for the Judged Rose Show, which runs from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Swanson expects 200 to 250 roses to be on display. Anyone can enter roses from 8 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. For more information, call Swanson at 402-493-5986. At the end of the show, the spent roses used to be tossed. But Omaha Rose Society member Richard Ulmer decided that was a waste. Several years ago, Ulmer and several helpers gathered up their roses and delivered them to a senior living facility. That's the plan this time, too. We're just going through the whole place, just knocking on the door and saying, would you like to have a rose? And bingo, everyone says yes, Ulmer said. Ulmer and another crew are in charge of deadheading all the roses weekly at the Memorial Park Gardens. Ulmer is in his 90s. Lorenzen Gardens will be back to standard operation next weekend, and the event is included with paid garden admission and is free to garden members. Timed tickets are still available to expedite the entry process, but are no longer required for guests. Swanson says this is the finest spring he can remember for roses, which are about a week ahead of their usual bloom times. We had the wet period when then heat, then it cooled back down. The weather and rainfall have combined to give us a good year, he said. I haven't seen any disease and very little insect damage. It looks like I'm going to be able to take roses to the show. You are listening to a reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, June 10th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, why don't we turn to today's obituaries. Gary Kunzelman. Gary Kunzelman, age 66, passed away unexpectedly but peacefully Thursday, June 3rd, 2021. Gary was born September 8, 1954, in Omaha, Nebraska, to Dolores and Jim Kunzelman. Gary grew up in the Atlantic, Iowa area and graduated from Atlantic High School in 1973. Gary married Pat Bange in November 75, and they welcomed a daughter, Chris J., in January of 1977. Gary worked at Levain's Auto Dealership in Atlantic until 1985. In August 1985, Gary reunited and married Donna Rold, his high school sweetheart. He and daughter Chris then relocated to Omaha, Nebraska. Gary worked at Nebraska Technical Services, the fun company, until his passing. Gary was known for his dry humor, few words, and sarcastic one-liners. Gary looked forward to spending time with Donna, Chris, son-in-law Travis, and grandchildren Chase and Haley, especially during family vacations in the Ozarks. His favorite pastime was spoiling his grandkids, chasing a golf ball around the course, feeding an occasional slot machine, and playing cribbage with Jack and water. Gary was also up for a stop at a good dive bar or local watering hole. He was preceded in death by his parents, mother and father-in-law, grandparents, and Uncle Bill Robinson and cousin Dwayne Altworth. Gary is survived by his wife Donna, daughter Chris, her husband Travis Berkamina, grandchildren Chase and Haley, all of Washington, Iowa, brother Doug and wife Brenda Kunzelman of Tulsa, Oklahoma, sister-in-law Jan Falsberg and Marilyn Krause of Omaha, brother-in-law Darren Rold of Lee Summit, Missouri, and cherished Aunt Joyce Robinson of Clendmont, Missouri, many nieces and nephews. In lieu of flowers and trees, a memorial fund has been established in honor of Gary Kunstelman for the Lewis Oakwood Cemetery in Lewis, Iowa. A celebration of life will be held Saturday, June 12th from 2 to 4 p.m. at Sugar's Restaurant and Lounge, 2725 East Canesville Boulevard, Council Bluffs, Iowa. Luanna Pauline Evans. Luanna Pauline Evans, 81, of West Liberty, Iowa, passed away Sunday, June 6, 2021, at her home in West Liberty. Luanna was born September 28, 1939, in Council Bluffs, Iowa, the daughter of Russell and Ina Smith. On August 24, 1973, she was united in marriage to Walter Evans, the love of her life. Luanna was an avid Iowa Hawkeye, St. Louis Cardinal, and racing fan, and never shied away from letting everyone know it too. She spent many years in a variety of jobs, but totally reveled in her favorite position, mom. Although she was a mother to few, if she welcomed you into her home, she was always your mom. She is survived by her children, Kay Matheny of Tipton, Iowa, Luann Helm of Tipton, Iowa, Russ Rockwell of Clarinda, Washington, Michael Stewart of Des Almendez, Louisiana, Dennis Evans of Alamosa, Iowa, Todd Roberts of Council Bluffs, Iowa, Kathy Evans of Oxford, Iowa, Scooter Evans of West Liberty, Iowa, also 23 grandchildren, 35 and 3/4 great-grandchildren, and 4 great-great-grandchildren. 3 siblings, Jack Smith of Council Bluffs, Iowa, Sherry McCary of Glenwood, Iowa, and LaDonna Kastman of Sioux Rapids, Iowa, as well as her dog, Bo. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband Walt, who obviously was having too much fun upstairs and needed to be reined in, and dog Freckles. A memorial visitation will be held Friday, June 11th, 2021, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the West Liberty Community Center, 1204 North Calhoun Street, West Liberty, Iowa, with memorial services beginning at 2 p.m., followed by graveside service held at North Prairie Cemetery in West Liberty, Iowa. Luncheon will follow at the West Liberty Community Center. The Henderson Baker Funeral Home in West Liberty is caring for for Luanna's family. Paul M. Heath. Paul M. Heath, age 65, passed away June 7, 2021. He was born August 8, 1955, to Robert and Norma Heath in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He was preceded in death by his father, Robert Heath, nephew Adam Heath. Paul is survived by his wife Joan Heath, mother Norma Heath, children Jennifer and Jay Parker, and Jeff Heath, siblings Judy Dillon, Larry Heath, and Lucy Kane, 7 grandchildren, a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. at Hoy Kulczyski Funeral Home on Saturday, June 13th. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. at Hoy Kulczyski Funeral Home on Monday, June 14th, 2021. Interment is in Ridgewood Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. Bruce Lee Gilliatt. Bruce Lee Gilliatt, 71, of Council Bluffs, Iowa, passed away June 5th, 2021, at his home. Bruce was born on March 20th, 1950, in Omaha, Nebraska. He graduated from St. Albert High School in 1969. Bruce was preceded in death by his mother, Raymond Van Clear, and stepfather, Harold Gilliatt. Bruce is survived by beloved life partner, Carolyn Sue Corwin, daughter and son-in-law, Kelly Jeremy Grimm of Bennington, Nebraska, brother and spouse, Stephen and Patty Gillette, sister and spouse Patricia, and Harold V. McLean, all of Council Bluffs. Funeral information. Bruce will be cremated and a private family memorial service will be held at a later date. That wraps up today's obituaries. Why don't we dive into the opinion section? Kicking off the opinion section today is the Your Views opinions. First up, Neighborhood Works in Council Bluffs. Neighborhood Works Home Solutions is proud to be part of the Council Bluffs community. Since 2013, Neighborhood Works Home Solutions staff have worked with our board and community stakeholders to identify and develop solutions that address Council Bluffs' needs in affordable housing, neighborhood revitalization, financial capability, and more. Neighborhood Works Home Solution can provide these services because of the support and commitment to our mission. You can read more about the impact of Neighborhood at neighborhoodworkshomesolutions.org. Residents in Council Bluffs and across the country want to create vibrant and welcoming places everyone wants to call home. But to accomplish this goal, bridging the wealth and attainment gaps that allow Council Bluffs residents to improve their own financial future is critical. Neighborhood Works Home Improvement is helping people bypass challenges and improve their lives. Neighborhoods and communities are where people interact most frequently. Addressing problems like crime that seem too large to solve on a national scale seem more manageable when neighbors come together. That's why Neighborhood Works Week, June 5 through 12, an annual week of service where Neighborhood Works, Home Solutions, and other Neighborhood Works organizations across the country highlight neighborhood change and awareness and a host of events that educate, train, and inform is so transformative. Since its inception in 1983, Neighborhood Works Week highlights the collective impact of the Neighborhood Works Network and how each organization takes a unique, tailored approach to serving its particular neighborhood or community. Neighborhood Works Week helps to showcase leaders who care deeply about their community and bring people together to tackle tough challenges, create change, and build stronger communities. Neighborhood Works Home Solutions and all members of the National Neighborhood Works Network provide the local, on-the-ground work building and restoring communities all are proud to call home. Council Bluffs residents have struggled with affordable housing options. That's why Neighborhood Works Home Solutions is providing new and rehabbed affordable housing units, multifamily rental opportunities, home ownership education, and counseling in the communities we serve. To solve the social inequalities and wealth gaps residents experience in Council Bluffs, organizations like Neighborhood Works Home Solutions are working daily to provide essential services that inform lives. Large, long-lasting challenges begin with local, on-the-ground work of neighborhoods and residents. That opinion and article was sent in by David Hazelwood, Chief Operating Officer, Neighborhood Works Home Solutions, Council Bluffs. Next opinion from Your Views section, Axne does what she says she'll do. As a union plumber and labor advocate, I have long since learned that when it comes to politicians, what they do is more important than what they say. Since joining Congress in July of 2019, Representative Cindy Axne has been a strong and consistent advocate for Iowa's working families. In the current session, Representative Axne was the only Iowa Congressmember to vote for the American Rescue Plan, in addition to the stimulus and unemployment protections many of us know about. That plan also included passage of the Butch Lewis Emergency Pension Relief Act, a single law that will preserve and protect the pension plans of more than 1 million American workers, including thousands of current workers and retirees in Iowa. On March 9, Representative Axne, again the only Iowa Congressmember to vote for passage of the PRO, Protect the Right to Organize Act. This act is essential to working people in America and would prohibit the kind of union busting that just occurred with Amazon workers in Alabama. The PRO Act is a necessary step to pushing back against the out-of-control wage inequality and increasing wealth gap between workers and billionaires in this country. Workers must have the power to bargain collectively for better wages and benefits so we can bring back our thriving middle class. Representative Axne understands that. Lots of politicians like to talk about workers at election time, but then go to D.C. and act on the behalf of donors instead. If you say you are for Iowans working families, but you don't vote for the kind of legislation that makes Iowa workers' lives better, then why should we vote for you? Representative Axne is the only Iowa Congress member who consistently stands with and votes on behalf of working people of Iowa. We count on her to carry our voices to D.C. and work to make our lives better, and she does. If only we had 3 more congresswomen and men like her. That was by Jeff Sudik, President, Western Iowa Labor Federation, Council Bluffs. The next opinion from the Our Views section, headline reads, Farmers on Front Lines of Climate Change. Farmers are on the front lines of climate change, with higher temperatures and changing weather patterns impacting crop conditions and productivity. That is why farmers in Iowa and nationwide deserve a seat at the table for environmental policy discussions that impact our livelihoods. We need lawmakers to pass smart, climate-friendly policies that combat climate change while increasing economic opportunities for farmers. That includes supporting the clean energy industry that has become a key feature of Southwest Iowa's economy. Iowa is fortunate to be leading in more than one form of clean energy, including wind and biofuels. With lower emissions, increase opportunities in rural communities, and add to America's energy security. We should continue advocating cleaner alternatives to fight climate change while supporting local jobs, businesses, and industries. With their largest support of the Growing Climate Solutions Act, Senator Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst prove once again that they're champions of Iowa's farmers and building Iowa's stature in emerging fields like clean energy. This bill would make it easier for farmers to participate in voluntary carbon credit markets, incentivizing the adoption of sustainable agriculture techniques and reduce carbon pollution. This bill even has widespread bipartisan support, even outside the Capitol. Agricultural groups like the American Farm Bureau Federation, National Corn Growers Association, American Soybean Association, and National Pork Producers Council have all come out in support of the legislation. Farmers are ready to be part of the climate solution. We just need Congress to make that possible. Thank you, senators, for playing your part. That was by Dwayne Astrapor of Randolph. That wraps up the opinions for today. We are going to move into an article from the Arts and Entertainment section. The headline reads, Miller to perform play about Iowa artist Grant Wood. This was filed by Tim Johnson of the Nonpareil. A local reenactor will dramatize the childhood of Iowa artist Grant Wood in a special presentation Friday at the Hoff Family Arts and Cultural Center, 1001 South 6th Street in Council Bluffs. The one-night-only event starts at 7 p.m. with the gallery and cocktail bar open early for guests to explore. The two-act play, Wood, will be performed by Dick Miller, frequent supporter of the arts in the community, who also wrote and directed it. The 45-minute performance will be followed by drinks and a discussion of the artist's work with Miller, according to a press release from Pottawatomie Arts, Culture, and Entertainment. The audience will learn about Grant Wood's life and legacy, including the story of American Gothic, Wood's most recognizable painting. He's got 100 surprising stories to tell, Dana Coleman, CEO of Pace, said about Miller's depth of knowledge. He's researched and read all the books. He genuinely loves the artist and knows small details that bring Grant Wood's story to life. In addition to being a Grant Wood enthusiast, Miller is also a longtime pillar of Bluffs arts community. He's supported many local projects and arts initiatives, including the preservation of Woods Corn Murals, the press release stated. The murals were the largest project which brought wood to Council Bluffs for the first time. Now, large parts of the restored mural live in Hoff Center's Richard and Deanna Grant Miller Wood Gallery, making it the perfect place to bring Grant Wood's story to life. Every year, Iowa students learn about Grant Wood and his historic legacy. He championed rural America and painted its people and landscapes with love, humor, and skill. But, as Miller will point out, guests do not have to already know about the renowned regionalist painter to enjoy his life. Grant Wood is an Iowa treasure, Miller said, but most people don't know about his dramatic childhood. His father abused him for painting, but his mother secretly supported his dreams. It's the challenges that set Wood on the road to greatness and a coming-of-age story that every age can learn from. Doors open at 5 p.m., and seats are free but limited. Reservations are available at paceartsiowa.org/events. Hopping on over to the sports section, our first story is NJCAA National Tournament. The headline reads, Rivers Advance to Championship. This was filed by Peter Hunigan of the Nonpareil. Iowa Western men's soccer played Iowa Lakes five times this season, but Wednesday's victory in Wichita, Kansas over the conference foe was the sweetest victory for the Rivers, who clinched a spot in the national championship game with a win over conference foe. IWCC won the first three games against Iowa Lakes before coming to a draw in the fourth. The Rivers won Tuesday's game by a score of 3-0. Iowa Western returns to the national championship for the first time since 2013 when they brought the trophy back. It's awesome to get the program back to a national championship game, head coach Mike Brown said. Hats off to Iowa Lakes. The fact that we had two Iowa teams in the national semifinals should say enough about the strength of our conference. Iowa Western scored their first goal 5 minutes into the game when Evan Southerner scored after the Iowa Lakes goalkeeper came out for a ball and passed Southern. But Southern slid the ball into the bottom corner for the 1-0 lead. The one-goal lead lasted until the 47th minute of Southern when Southern scored his second goal of the game. He got behind the back line and dried up the center back and slid the ball into the bottom left corner. The final goal came in the 81st minute of a free track when Merdy Nicoli was fouled. Diego Quintana hit a ball to the front post and Ibrahim came across and headed the ball back into the net. Iowa Western goalkeeper Patrick Millard finished the game with two saves as the Rivers defense held the Lakes offense to just three shots on goal and seven shots total. Just who we are is the key, Brown said. We are a pressing team. We kill teams in transition. We do a lot of things, very strong offset paces offensively. Those areas we did a really good job in. We got three goals off these things. I think for me, I'm really proud of the boys. Brown pointed to Nika Kolo, Joel Quashing, Mosey Batu, Giorgio Pablo as just a few of the players that played a big role. As a team, everyone did their job today, he said. The team was great. Iowa Western will play at 7 p.m. tonight for a shot at the national championship. The other semifinal had yet to be concluded at the time of print. The next story is about softball, and the headline reads, Saints Buzz by Yellow Jackets, filed by Austin Hunan of the Nonpareil. The St. Albert softball team defeated inner-city foe Thomas Jefferson by scoring the five unanswered runs to finish the game with a 5-1 win. We needed this one, Saints coach Lindsay Daly said. We've been in a lot of close games this year and just haven't been able to pull it off. so this was a nice one to get. City wins are always big for us. Amy Anderson always has her girls ready to go. Like always, they came ready to fight here, so it was a key win for us tonight. The Yellow Jackets struck fast as they plated a run in the first inning to take a quick 1-0 lead. After going scoreless in the bottom half of the first, the Saints scored the equalizer as Landry Miller scored the trying run in the bottom of the second of an RBI single from freshman Sophie Sheffield. The Saints then took advantage as Sophie's sister, Lainey Sheffield, hit a solo homer to center field. Mallory DeLaley hit a surface grounder that brought Olivia Grander home to put the hosting Saints up 3-1. The score would stay the same until the bottom of the sixth when Miller hit two out and an in-the-park home run that also scored freshman Caitlin Hendricks to put St. Albert up 5-1. It's nice to get the team going like that, Miller said. It felt like that was a very high point in the game, and they just told me to keep going after sliding into third, and I went all the way. Freshman Alexis Narmi got the win on the mound with her season-best 15 strikeouts to keep the Jackets' batters in check. Getting an inner-city win was big, but winning after a few close defeats is also what Narmani and the Saints were looking for as they continued a busy June schedule. This is a big win for us, Narmani said. We've started off a little rough this year, so it was a game we came into expecting to win and wanted to win and needed to win, and especially with another great team like Harlan coming up next. This is a good win heading into that game, and hopefully this game prepared us a bit for Harlan. St. Albert will host Class 4A No. 14 Harlan at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday at Saints Softball Field. All right, here is another local story for you. Sheriff announces reward for information on missing Iowa boy, Montezuma, Associated Press. A sheriff announced Wednesday that roughly $15,000 and counting has been pledged as a reward to information that helps investigators find out what happened to a missing Iowa boy. The Poweshiek County Sheriff's Office and the pledges have come from local businesses and citizens who are concerned about the disappearance of Xavier Harrelson. The office said in a press release that Xavier was last seen on or about May 27th in Montezuma, a small town where he lived in a trailer with his mother. His 11th birthday was May 30th. Police have not said who last saw Xavier, who had recently completed fourth grade at a local public school. One of his neighbors, a mother of one, and Xavier's friend, was the first to report him missing. The reward fund has been created by Montezuma State Bank. The sheriff's office said the money should be paid out for information which leads to resolution of the case. And to round out today's reading, why don't we finish up with a fun little blurb that I like to read called Do Just One Thing. There's a big difference between bags and products labeled compostable versus biodegradable. Under normal composting situations, items labeled compostable will degrade over time as microbes feed on the items and break them down into beneficial mulch. Biodegradable items, on the other hand, could take months or years to break down under the right conditions. In a landfill situation, biodegradable products would stay totally intact since their conditions are not ideal for decomposition of these items. For compostable items, feel free to compost them at home or in your municipal composting program. Well, listeners and friends, that does it for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I've been your reader, Maddie Ryan. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And as always, Thanks so much for listening.